Let's Pod This. My name is Andy Moore. Friends, it's good to have you back with us again this week here live in the Democracy Den studios. I've got a good friend of mine in the studio again this week, your friend and mine, Dr. Keith Gaddy. Hello, Keith. How are you?
Doing good, Andy. How are you today?
I'm well. Good to see you. Thanks for coming back on. I know you've been driving back and forth between Oklahoma City and Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm.
You had a King Tut statue of some kind this week I saw in your car.
Yes, I did. My mother bought that in the late 70s when Tut was a thing.
Yeah.
And it always sat somewhere in the house growing up. And I was at her house the other day and Tut was sitting in the back of the food pantry. And I said, Mama, what are you going to do with Tut? And she said, well, I'm going to give him to you, I guess.
Right.
So he's sitting down in my office at TCU now.
Nice.
Yeah.
I love a good bust of a historical figure.
Yes.
I should finish that sentence very quickly.
You brought it home just fine, Andy. Well done.
Well, Keith, today I think we're going to have a conversation that is about current events and also not about current events. We're going to like pull up to a 30,000 foot view of American politics and where we're at as a country and perhaps where we're going or where we could go.
Yeah.
And that necessarily means we have to start with looking at where we've been. So we're going to talk about, what does a winning liberalism look like?
Mm-hmm.
We may get into conservatism in today's world. What is conservatism with and without racism? Where does that intersection lie? And then just kind of go from there. Does that sound good?
Yeah. And if we don't get to all of it, there's always next time.
There's always next time.
And, Andy, as I was driving over here today, I got thinking, I want the listener to imagine, dear listener, this is for you. Imagine, when you have that evening where you have like six or eight friends over and there's dinner and it starts slow and you all sit around and then eventually all the food has been eaten and the plates are still on the table and that next bottle of wine has been opened and you get into this sort of measured, interesting conversation. You end up in a deep dive somewhere, or maybe mm-hmm. you've gone in the living room, there's a fire in the fireplace. That's the kind of talk that Andy and I are going to have this evening.
Yeah.
Even though we're recording this at 11 in the morning. This evening, we're going to have that kind of conversation for you, we hope.
That is my favorite time of a dinner party. We, in the early days of the podcast, we did an episode where we had Clayton Barr, who's at the time his handle on social media was The Wine Doctor, and he came on, we did a wine pairing with elected offices, and it was a delightful meal. We had several bottles of wine at Scott's house. It was a great conversation. We did not air all of it. There's a point at which we're like, okay, turn everything off, because now we're getting a little too opinionated.
Yes, absolutely. And what we're going to try and do is we're going to try and keep it, if not sober, sober-ish.
There we go.
Sober-ish.
Right.
Yeah.
Mostly because it's 11 o'clock. We can come back and return to a bourbon-infused episode in the future. So I think let's start, Keith, with thinking about, where you define modern liberalism beginning. I think about the New Deal mm-hmm. and like FDR in that era, but how about you?
Well, I think for contemporary liberalism, the liberalism that we operate in the United States, it really does start with the New Deal and also some aspects of progressivism that had happened before that. So you look at some of the things Woodrow Wilson was trying to do when he wasn't busy being a racist. And you look at some of the things that were coming out of Bob La Follette and the progressives in Wisconsin. And then some of this makes its way into the 1928 Democratic Party platform. I think it gets full manifestation in the New Deal.
Okay. And we're thinking 1920s-ish is where
1924, because at that point we're in a technological environment that kind of looks like what we're going to be in for the next 75 years.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And we're in an economic order that's being created that contains a lot of the challenges that America will have socially and economically for the next 75 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to talk about that because, you've heard me say before privately, the New Deal had a great run.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's ever been able to figure out how to follow it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of what we have to talk about.
Yeah. Because it's real funny. I just started watching The Gilded Age on HBO recently, which is the same era, right? And so this is a really well-timed conversation, selfishly for me, because you have in the 1920s, in The Gilded Age, this immense wealth gap,
mm-hmm.
right? And then really, how do we as a country respond to that? And so it's really, I think this is just well-timed because we have an enormous wealth gap right now that not enough people are talking about. So, you know, once this, well, let's talk about how the New Deal coalition came together and then what happened as it kind of fell apart.
Yeah. I mean, the big parts of the New Deal coalition are organized labor, mm-hmm. okay? Farmers are a big part of this as well. Southerners in general, because they are Democrats, and outside of the South, African Americans. These are the key pieces of the New Deal coalition. And part of what that does is it sets up an inherent conflict once the coalition comes together of trying to have a political movement that involves African Americans in the northern cities and segregationist whites in the South. Hmm. But the key here is that we've got farmers who constantly confront economic challenges and environmental challenges throughout the history of the United States, and who are most often suffer when depressions occur because prices on commodities completely collapse. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the working class, which is attempting to find a way to get to more than just simply a living wage. These are both groups that are often in conflict with major infrastructure corporations, which means transportation in the form of railroads, and banking. Okay, they're in conflict with finance, they're in conflicts with transportation, and with large industry, those who benefit most in the Gilded Age. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, when the Great Depression comes along, it's permissible to put a winning coalition together in that space. Mm. But it's also informed by a big shift in thinking about America, about economics around the world, which is what happens during the Great Depression and the creation of the New Deal. For the first time, governments around the world are buying into Keynesian economics and the idea of basically engaging in decoupling money from metalism and engaging in the accrual of debt.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, and so as the New Deal coalition falls apart, mm-hmm. Identity politics really can't sustain a majority, right? And so, and identity politics, I think, kind of emerged because certain groups were excluded.
Yeah, and you know, you think about it, the great challenge in America, and this is where I always shill my book, right? Nick Davis and Kirby Goidell and I talk about this in our book, Democracy's Meanings, is that the challenge for American democracy is in trying to make the idealized promise of the Enlightenment values of the late 18th century real for all individuals, irrespective of gender or race or economic class, okay, or ethnic origin. And that's where our struggle is in identity politics, is after World War II, we've got the momentum because we are the only major economy standing with absolutely no devastation to our landscape. We have half the world's GDP. Half the global economy is in
America.
North America. Yeah. We have that. We have 20 working people for every individual receiving Social Security benefits, right? We have this unusually young, vibrant, untouched population with massive economic growth taking hold after the immediate post-war recession in 46. And so now the time has come to make the promise real for people. And that's why the Civil Rights Movement gets momentum. It's why the Women's Liberation Movement gets momentum. It's why the environmental movement gets legs in the 60s and 70s, is we have so much wealth and we've seen what government can do in the sphere of the New Deal. We think we can do a lot of things with it. Mm. But the problem is it also creates tensions in the New Deal coalition, because if you're going to go after segregation, you've created a rift between all those Southern whites that contributed to your sustained majority.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what does a modern day, like 21st century New Deal coalition look like?
Well, it's the parts that contribute to it are way smaller. Let's start with that.
You mean like more small pieces?
No, the pieces have shrunk. So for example, you know, I think it's something like 35% of all people who were employed in the United States after World War II were members of unions. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now that number is significantly smaller. And the industries that created union jobs have either evolved due to technology and started evolving due to technology in the 1970s through automation, or they've gone offshore. And so what happens is that working union class gets squeezed and shrunk and gets repositioned, right? And unions get undermined systematically by the placement of right-to-work laws in different states. In Oklahoma, this was a closed shop state until the beginning of the 21st century. And so as a consequence, a lot of those old union jobs are now non-union.
Right.
A lot of those union industries have either shrunk and gone away. I mean, everybody forgets, we used to build cars in Oklahoma City for right. General Motors,
yeah.
Right?
Not that long ago.
Not that long ago, yeah. And now we don't. So, you know, we've seen the disappearance of those industries and the disappearance of those opportunities. And you think about it, there was a man once who came home from World War II. And he got married to his high school sweetheart, and then he got a job out at the Tinker Assembly Plant for a very good wage, hanging right doors on cars. Mm-hmm. And he was able to afford a home in the suburbs that had three bedrooms, 1.5 baths, and a two-car garage. And he was able to secure a lot on a lake and build a cabin out there, and he had a boat. And his children grew up going to the lake in a working-class family. Mm-hmm. And enjoying that recreation and enjoying a home where if mom decided to stay home, she could. Mm-hmm. Or if she wanted to work, she could. And those children went to college. And they were able to afford to go to college because it was significantly subsidized by the state. Mm-hmm. And they were able to get degrees. And then they graduated and they got jobs. But both of them had to work to maintain a middle class existence. And maybe they're still enjoying their parents' lake house now and then. And then their child is born and grows up and goes into the National Guard to help underwrite the cost of going to college, which is largely not subsidized by the state. And then they get activated to go off to the Gulf War. And they do two tours, and they go to Afghanistan, and they come to Iraq, and they come back. And the jobs that they can find are not enough to maintain a mortgage mm-hmm. or to raise a family, even though these are the same people doing largely the same things. The biggest benefit of that New Deal coalition and that unique economy was to create a middle-class existence for working-class individuals. It's unique in human it's unique in American history to have the ability to do that.
That's such a great like illustration mm-hmm. of what's happened in the last 60 years, right? 70 yeah. years. 100 years, I guess.
Yeah.
Totally, but I was just thinking, because that, like, the last person in the story is me, right? Mm-hmm. Like, my grandfather, you know, was in Korea and Vietnam, and he worked at a television plant in East Texas for a while. He was yeah. a firefighter in the Air Force. You know, his daughter, my mom, went to some college, but didn't graduate, but married a guy, and she was a homemaker. And my dad was a mechanical engineer, technician for microfilm machines and, you know, kind of in technology on the early days. And then I came along, went to college. And while I think I'm probably as well off or better off my parents were at the same age, it is still impossible for us to, like, pay for our house and, like, have a lake house or mm-hmm. those kinds of things. And, like, the idea of my kids going to college in a few years is already causing us a lot of anxiety because the price tag on college is enormous now compared to what it was, even for a state school, even if you're smart and you get, mm-hmm. I mean, I got a scholarship to college for academics that was only 20% of my tuition and I could only get one B in the first year. I had to get all A's. Otherwise I would lose it. And I was like, well, this is unsustainable. So it strikes me that I think, but you know, basically the old New Deal coalition worked in its time, but America looks very different now than it did 100 right. years ago. And so, like, a winning liberalism today has to blend economics and cultural pluralism, right? Some prosperity mm-hmm. with belonging. Is that correct?
Yeah. And I think, in a way, we might be getting there. But one of the things it requires is we have to accept pluralism in all areas. And if you look at the realignment of American politics that's been underway, we've had this dramatic change in the nature of the GOP coalition, right? Which is, it is more working class. It is less college educated. It's largely older, but it's attempting to brown and black itself. I mean, you know, if Donald Trump getting 1 in 4 black male votes is sustainable for the GOP, that recognizes in part a change in the solidarity of the black vote in terms of its homogeneity being driven by the issues of the New Deal and the Great Society, mm-hmm. that we're moving past that, that, that these communities are evolving and becoming less homogeneous. Economic prosperity in these communities.
That's interesting. Identity politics didn't appear out of nowhere, right? It was a response to people being left out, mm-hmm. and how to kind of integrate those voices into a broader unifying story. Do you think it's just that the coalitions have shifted, or do you think that there are, like, I almost feel like there are, we are so scattered, like so divided into so many identity groups that it is tough to build a cohesive coalition of anything. Cause there's like, yeah, you're just trying to like get a whole bucket of marbles together and make them form into groups. And that's really hard.
Yeah. And you think about it, this is where maybe the first thing we have to recognize in imagining what aliberalism is, mm-hmm. for the future, is to let go of what it was in the past. And, you know, as I said earlier, the New Deal had a great run, and the Great Society had a great moment. But one of the things we know about good governing is we should revisit problems and reexamine them, right? Mm. And in one of my areas of expertise, voting rights, the original Voting Rights Act was designed so that Congress would periodically come back, revisit it, tweak it, and then recognize progress. And one of the things we've seen is that act has been knocked back by the courts, is that its core mission of guaranteeing access to the ballot, it still generally succeeds in making sure that people can vote, okay? And in fact, in areas where you've got relatively large black populations in the South, such as Georgia, black voter participation has sustained itself, black political empowerment has sustained itself. It's not in a winning coalition in Georgia yet, but it could be in the future. Mm-hmm. Is it permissible for us to evolve laws in these areas? Right now, the court is doing it, and the high court looks adversarial in doing so. But then that forces you to look back and say, okay, well, if we don't have this guarantee, how do we create other guarantees? Where do we do it elsewhere?
Right.
And, you know, this goes to issues you and I have talked about in other places, where if you can get into a coalition in state politics, you can create these answers at the state level. So maybe one of the questions we have to ask is, if the old liberalism was always about egalitarianism, and always has been. So if you go back to the Jacksonians early on, right, you know, the post-Jeffersonians, it's about expanding the franchise. It's about finding land. It's about creating spaces on the frontier. And I'm speaking from a Western European coastal perspective, okay? And I know this thing, okay? And the first thing we have to do is get past the fact that people have assumptions, okay? But that assumption that we were pushing that frontier in part out of egalitarianism for that population.
Okay? Right.
Abolition of slavery is an egalitarian principle, that all individuals should be free and able to return their freedom, that you should not be able to place somebody in chattel slavery or in permanent indenture in perpetuity, let alone their children, that all people should be born free. That's very egalitarian. The idea that you should be able to take a job and earn a living wage. And by living wage, we don't mean not starve. We mean to be able to meet Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? And also have room in your life to rejuvenate yourself, to have rest and recreation and time for worship. These are all egalitarian principles, right?
Okay, it's just a good life.
It's a good life, yeah. And that's what it is. The true American dream is to be able to lead a good life and to put your children in a position to have an even better life and that follows on, mm-hmm. okay? That's the American dream as it's historically defined. So it's not necessarily about a big house and a big car and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. It's about the opportunity to have choices.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's freedom. It's about freedom.
So, I mean, it sounds like the left wins when they have a message that is aspirational, not defensive, right? Something right. that's saying like, when we rise together, rather than it's us versus them.
Right.
But I feel like right now, a lot of the messaging we hear from both sides, but and we'll talk about the left right now, is an us versus them. And I don't know if that's just because of who is the president and his stance, if it's a response to that, or if the left has lost their way.
I don't know. And I think we're going to be exploring this a lot in the coming year. I think this is the conversation that you and I are supposed to have. And we'll get some other people in here too. Yeah. And I keep thinking about the voices that succeed on the left. And often they're relatively centered voices. So Bill Clinton says, I still believe in a place called hope, right? Barack Obama and Michelle Obama say, when they go low, we go high, right?
They used to. I think Michelle backed off that recently.
That's okay. Michelle can do whatever she wants to. That's fine. That's fine. You know, and then Joe Biden came along and spoke, honestly, in the old New Deal language and did it so deftly and so quietly that they lost, right? So what the left has to do in part in American politics is get – or excuse me, what liberals have to get better at, because liberals and left are not the same thing.
That's true, yeah.
And what liberals have to do is get better about talking about those things that are generally shared by all Americans that are liberal, such as egalitarianism, and get better at credit claiming. Get better at credit claiming, taking credit for the things that are good that happen.
And that means more than just like a road sign saying, hey, this road construction was part of the bipartisan infrastructure bill.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, we all look at that and we blink because we don't have time to read all that stuff as we go by. We just see a big orange sign with black letters and think Oklahoma State's at it again.
Right.
But the, you know, so we keep going. Yeah, I think it's about creating a general environment where people want to live in that manner and appreciate the things that you're protecting for them.
Yeah.
And the problem is, you know, fear is persuasive. Fear is persuasive. And if you can scare someone into thinking that somebody's going to take something away from you, that can be motivating as well. And for the left, they've seen the fear-mongering on the right. And they've decided, well, we're going to lean in and do fear-mongering as well.
Right. Because clearly it's persuasive. It does work. Right.
And what liberalism does is it doesn't do fear-mongering.
Hmm.
It talks about virtue and opportunity and hope and how we create institutions and organizations and maybe policies that do that. But you have to put freedom at the fore in that, right?
So Ezra Klein's new book, Abundance, I don't know if you've had a chance to read it yet, but from my perspective of reading it and then the number of times I've seen it mentioned, both among Democrats and Republicans, especially in Congress or staffers on the Hill, are starting to shift around to this like abundance mindset, which strikes me as a bit of a old school liberalism, egalitarianism of like, hey guys, like we could do great things.
Yeah.
We don't have to get mired in bureaucracy and like hand wringing about, is this the exact right thing? We can just do really good things for many people.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that is resonant enough with voters to take hold.
Well, I think if you show people something hopeful, they'll gravitate to it. You know, they will. They will. Everybody wants to be part of something good.
Mm.
You know, ultimately, you want to be part of something good, something that reinforces you, something that gives you hope. And, you know, in the past from time to time, we've talked about Thomas Frank and, you know, what's the matter with Kansas. And, you know, I've said before, the reason that evangelical Christianity works so well is that it had a message for people about identity that made them feel included, those who felt the appeal of fundamentalism and literalism, but also those churches themselves provided community goods and public goods. And I think this is where we ought to start this conversation in earnest, Andy, is we ought to talk about public goods and collective goods and community goods.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm gonna give you a clean definition of this, everybody, so just hold on tight. And we start from there because both good liberalism and good conservatism should be built around these things. And this feeds into the abundance mindset.
Yeah.
Okay? Yeah. I mean, okay. So we're going totally public choice economics here, guys, but I'm gonna keep it simple. A public good is something that anybody can enjoy and it doesn't come at the cost of anyone else enjoying it. National defense is a public good. Clean air is a public good. Swimmable waters are a public good. I can swim in a clean lake. You can swim in a clean lake, and it's still a clean lake, right? My enjoying it doesn't diminish your enjoying it. Those are public goods.
Is this on a personal level, though? Because some, you know, a factory that also shares that lakeshore might say, yeah, but you're infringing my right to dump this refuse in the lake.
Exactly, and that's where we get into this thing called externalities, okay? And what an externality is, it's a when you engage in a market activity like, let's suppose you got a factory that's building washing machines, right? And it's emitting air pollution, and you've got an environmentally friendly laundry next door that dries their sheets in the wind. And now the pollution is tainting those sheets as they dry, right? Mm-hmm. You've created an economic externality because you've taken a side effect of your economic activity, you've dumped it into the public good.
Okay.
And now you've privatized that good for your own good, and you're injuring someone else. And, this is the classic example, right? So part of it is also about accountability. And if you're going to do that, you have an obligation to compensate the rest of us for your activity. Now, for those of you that are sitting here going, well, Keith, what do you call this? I have an economics degree, and you're talking about a Calder-Hicks transfer. And we're not going to go into that in detail, but basically, if I'm polluting and you're affected, I should compensate you for that out of my profit. Mm-hmm. And that's a very old-fashioned conservative principle.
Essentially carbon credits, right?
Yeah, carbon credits are a classic example. And carbon credits were advanced by a guy named George Bush,
right?
Who was not exactly a liberal in 1989, yeah. Okay? The Clean Air Act renewal in 1990 included carbon tax credits and basically brought pollution into the marketplace. And it was profitable. That's mm-hmm. the thing. It was also profitable. The thing is, it's hard for me to directly compensate you or your intern or the person down the hallway. Mm-hmm. But if I transfer that back to government and government acts to reallocate these monies to everybody's benefit, that's how a Calder-Hicks transfer can logically work. That's how you deal with this kind of problem of somebody trying to privatize a public good. Or mm-hmm. At that point, it's become a collective good, but still. Collective goods we all enjoy together, but it's also permissible for your activity to affect my enjoyment of it. Mm. So we create this regulatory regime to do this. And I know I just use the word regulation. We create a marketplace to do this.
Right.
And what is a regulatory regime except a marketplace that has rules to design the market to not cheat anybody?
Right.
That's all a good marketplace, a regulated marketplace, is simply a place where we can buy, sell, and trade without anyone getting cheated.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you were talking about public good, and I interrupted you, and then we got into collective good. And
which was where we were going to go next.
Right.
Yeah. So a good liberalism is about identifying those places, and a good conservatism is identifying those places where we're engaging in activities that we benefit from, and we try and find mechanisms, whether in the marketplace or in spiritualism or through government, to mitigate that harm and compensate people who were doing nothing but minding their own business, and then they got hurt. That's all we're doing. Is we're simply making sure that when I do a thing to profit, I don't injure you. You do a thing to profit, you don't injure me. Or we come up with a means to say, it's basically putting dollar signs on I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. We kind of touched on something about conservatism I want to come back to now while we've got a few minutes this week. The conservatism has a proud conservative tradition of community, of stewardship, of responsibility, mm-hmm. but too often, especially in today's world, that gets overshadowed by grievance and racism.
Right.
And do you think if conservatives want to be taken seriously without racism, that they need to show policies that make up for that in some way? How do they, you and I both know plenty of Republicans who are really frustrated, if not overtly worried, about the direction their party's going, and I think a wise conservative is looking ahead, 20 years, thinking, hey, we could start losing here and get way out of power in a while if we don't get our head around some of these big issues like racism. How do they avoid getting overshadowed by grievance politics that are rooted in race?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is unpack that a Republican and a conservative and a racist are not the same thing.
Right, yes.
And it's just a matter of if the conservatives are the dog, they laid down in a particular part of the house and the fleas got on them,
mm-hmm.
okay? And the racists are the fleas,
mm-hmm.
okay? And then the racists then the fleas became the dog, right? Okay.
There's so many fleas that took over.
Yeah, yeah. And it's in part due to a very cynical strategy that started being pursued actually in the late 1940s in Texas and early 1950s by conservatives on the north side of Dallas to attempt to break the Democratic Party's coalition in Texas by peeling off racial conservatives, okay? And this became the genesis of what was called the Southern Strategy in the 1960s and came to full fruition with Ronald Reagan's election in 1980, at which point white Southerners had completely left the Democratic Party to vote Republican, and then they just kept joining in and joining in for the next 15 years. Conservatism is very much about tradition. We should start with that. It is very much about virtues of prudence and of limitations, right? But it also has a strong Calvinist theocratic streak running through it. That's not to say it's Christian, but it has a strong Calvinism that runs through it. And it's suspicious of government power. It's suspicious of uninformed masses. And Ronald Reagan said we need an informed patriotism, right? And I think that is indicative of what conservatism consistently in the Anglosphere in Canada, the United States, England, always looks like. It's very much about institutional structure and having those with wealth, experience, and education acting as a prudent brake on those spendthrift, willy-nilly masses who, you know, what was it, Mitt Romney said they want food and shelter and things like that, you know, that whole 47% argument. And in a way, there's an appeal to that because in the American case in particular, Americans are a very unusual lot, irrespective of race, which is we are aspirant, right? We are industrious. We want things. We want freedom. We want economic things. We want indulgences. We want all of it, right? And we want opportunity. We want opportunity. And we may have become sufficiently institutionalized as a society and a culture that the thing I just articulated, the old work ethic, migrant, American frontier spirit, we've been on this continent for 405 years, the Anglos have, right? It may just be that we've become something different. We have to think towards the future about what our conservatism and our liberalism looks like in meeting that. Because looking back to these old models that are part of our whole 19th century frontier pushing experiment, which I talked about earlier, maybe it doesn't apply so much anymore. But we have to think about what are the conservative virtues. And the conservative virtue is to stop and think before you set something aside, before you let go of it, right? The difference between liberalism and the left, and I think we saw this as a meme several times, is that liberalism would say there are values and virtues to us as a society that will meet our people, and we need to change the people in power to have that. Leftism would say we have to change the institutions themselves, right? Because that has been a leftist approach to things, going back to the Marxist revolutions of the 1840s in Europe. And I think, Andy, I think where you and I reside as good government people is we think that there are certain institutions that need to evolve because they have lost their egalitarianism in terms of popular control, and also they've lost the ability to deal with the hopes, dreams, and ambitions of the public, that they've been captured by very particular interests who are simply trying to take public goods and make them collective, right? That they're trying to put together a club that grabs the profits of government expenditure or grabs the profits of regulation. And they try and lock those up just for themselves and their members of their club. Okay, segregation did this in the South. In a Southern city before World War II, you would have public parks and public swimming pools and trolley car lines and train lines and public buses. And you had public schools that were fantastic public schools. And white Southern taxpayers would pay for these things willingly in these cities because they were segregated. And then when we integrated these things, suddenly they became bad, right? Suddenly they became bad. And Kevin Kruse talks about this in his classic book, White Flight, which is about Atlanta and these dynamics. And after World War II, as integration comes, in these cities, but also other cities around the country, we pull back into private places, right? So we quit going to public swimming pools and public parks, and we start going to country clubs mm-hmm. and swim clubs. And we quit having homes in cities with mass transit, and we pull back into subdivisions. Mm-hmm. And those subdivisions have gates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And their own pool.
Yeah, and their own pool, exactly, yes. And we all grew up with this, right? I mean, not me. I grew up on a tobacco farm in rural Kentucky. And, you know, so my experience was a bit different. We had a three-acre pond. Yeah. But, yeah, this is the difference. This is what happens.
So that I think what you described there, right, that shift from – is a shift from the public good to yeah. this collective good to almost a private good.
Yeah, when you take a collective good, it's become what's called a club good.
Okay.
A club good is a shared – collective good that only members of the clubs get to
like a neighborhood pool that only people who live in that subdivision can access.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, this whole idea of the theory of clubs is one of the foundations of public choice economics. But it helps us understand the different ways we try and craft policy and decide what are the things that ought to be paid for by all the taxpayers, what are the things that ought to be provided by the individual. And then where are those places we ought to be able to come together as a group? Because the New Deal coalition benefited from club goods also. Unions are clubs.
Oh, sure.
And what does a union do? They negotiate a collective bargaining agreement with a business to provide the same benefits to all members, everybody who works there, provided they're paying union dues. They're a member of the club. A closed shop regulatory environment let you do that. In a right-to-work state, you can still have a union store, you can still have a unionized shop, mm-hmm. but the ability to provide the benefits from unionization only to union members doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So then you get into a thing called the free rider problem, which we'll discuss another time. But yeah, unions benefited, and the working class benefited from club membership as well. You think about it, if you're a member of an alumni association of a university, or better yet, you're over 55 and you're a member of AARP.
Hey, I'm a member of AARP.
Yeah, all these things that they provide for membership, mm-hmm. yeah, those are club goods. You're part of their club. So you get the airfare discount, the rental car discount, and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's funny. Well, I think I want a quick aside for anyone who happens to be watching this podcast. Listeners, you may forget that we have this as video. And we've reached the limit of the battery for the big light. It's 30 minutes, and the light went off. So now we're into a darker, moodier scene.
Keith and Andy after dark. This is excellent.
That's right, yeah. Well, it's good because we're almost at the end, so yeah. Now I know how long the battery lasts. But secondly, I think this makes me feel like America is in a clubization of mm-hmm. everything, right? I mean, literally, you go to Starbucks, you've got an app to use mm-hmm. that like is a club good for yeah. members of that coffee shop.
Yeah.
And you have those kind of things with everything, right? Like the proliferation of user groups and you know, the app for every restaurant to get mm-hmm. your points for everything. If you want to be a member of the YMCA yeah. or your local health club or whatever, like you were getting subscribed to death.
Exactly. I mean, 'twas the era of frequent flyer miles and the flyer's right to go there,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's very much what we're in right now. And what's nice is these little objects right here, I'm holding up my iPhone, they enable pressuring people into these clubs. Every time you do something, download our app, download our app, download our app. Mm-hmm. And the thing you're giving up really shouldn't be that big a deal. You're giving up your consumer information, right? You're giving up your transactions. And the thing that bothers me, though, is you're giving up your movement.
Oh, like your physical movement.
Your physical yeah. movement. And, you know, once upon a time, John Grisham wrote novels where one of the things that always happened with the protagonists is that they had to hide from the bad people and the law. Mm-hmm. And so they wouldn't use their credit cards, and they'd hop on their phone and they'd run to the Gulf Coast and pay for a place in Destin with cash.
Right.
I mean, the first eight novels, that always right. happened. That was his trope. Try and do that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's face it. We're all tracked.
I'm traveling next week. I'm to DC for a meeting. I'm just imagining walking into the hotel with like a big bag of cash. They wouldn't let you because you've got to prepay, right?
Right.
But if I was just like, no, I'm going to settle this right here with a stack of 20s, they would look at me like, you must be a criminal.
Yes. Well, you think about it. I think they still watermark check 20s, 50s, and 100s, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Even though a $20 bill is basically, you know, two cups of coffee and a bagel.
Yes.
You know, but you know, we are in the era of club goods. And Andy, you know what I think I'm going to say? I think you've given me the idea of the book that we ought to write.
All right.
This could be a good one. You know, just, you know, we're being clubbed to death.
There we go. That's a good title, I think. We can, well, let's do it. Keith, I think that's a good place to stop for this week.
Yes, sir.
You're coming back, though. We're going to keep this conversation going, right?
Yeah. It'll be a couple weeks where I can get in. Well, actually, if you want to pick this up the end of next week, I can do that. The week after that, I'm giving the Constitution Day talk at Western Kentucky University.
Very nice.
So I'll be over there talking about what comes after the Voting Rights Act. And then at the end of the month, I have to go to Colorado Springs to go to a relatively conservative conference called the Shawnee Trail Conference, which is all about constitutional rights and liberties coming from the original founding and how we carry those forward. So maybe in October when I get back, I can talk about what I've learned from that perspective. But I think we can just keep chatting about this stuff in bits and pieces. And maybe everybody else will set up late, have a glass of wine, and listen to us.
There you go. Yeah. Listeners, it's like a fireside chat for our listeners, right?
Yeah, it is a fireside chat.
Yeah.
And we need more of those.
We do. I'll see if I can find us a fireplace, then we'll use that for our future episodes.
Andy, I look forward to it.
Keith, thanks so much for being here this week. It's good to see you again.
Likewise.
Listeners, thank you for being here as well. We will be back next week. Listeners, if you have a question or a suggestion for the show, please send us an email at podcast@letsfixthis.org. And as always, remember that decisions are made by those who show up. We'll see you next week.